Welcome to Youth Speaks Out, a show for, by, and about young people. It airs on the first Sunday of each month from 3 to 4 p.m. and is hosted by young people in Mendocino County. We want to create a place where young people can talk truthfully about important issues in our lives and have a dialogue with the community of listeners. Today's hosts are me, Elios, and
Lexi,
and Miles.
We all attend local high schools.
Today our topic is Youth and Protecting the Environment. The terms climate change, ozone depletion, and global warming are frequently used in news reports and in our classrooms. Some people, mainly in America, continue to debate whether or not a human activity is significantly altering weather patterns. On a global scale, most scientists are reporting melting ice caps, increased species extinction, and ever-increasing pollution of the land, air, and water. The environment we live in, the one we depend on, is degrading, and most people see that the damage is accumulating to a crisis point. One of the first Americans to lead an organized stand on the conservation of the environment was John Muir. In 1892, John Muir and others formed the Sierra Club, which persuaded the federal government to preserve Yosemite as a national park. The goals of the club were to show how we could use natural resources without depleting them, enjoy natural beauty without destroying it, and take a more sustainable approach to the way we live.
Ecology is a branch of biology that deals with the relations of organisms to one another and their physical surroundings. The term ecology became popular in the 1960s by people who were concerned about the escalating pollution of the land, sea, and air. The Greens are a political party with ecology as a core value. Chief Seattle described ecology in 1854 when he said, quote, "Man does not weave the web of life. He is merely a strand in it. Whatever he does to the web, he does to himself."
At Willits High School, we have formed a club called Peaceworks. It is a student-run organization dedicated to the proliferation of sustainable peace. The organization works to attain this goal through various social and environmental actions. Some of these actions have included the cleanups of local waterways, as well as engaging civic leaders about the future of our community. An example of our work has been cleaning up Bechtel Creek southwest of Willits and Mill Creek next to the high school. We removed over 2,500 pounds of garbage and debris from one of these creeks. Today we have a special guest in the studio, Rachel Carson, who authored Silent Spring in 1962. Rachel passed on in 1964, but through the miracle of the Women's History Project and the dedication of Lexi Krause, Rachel will speak to us about her work and life.
Rachel was born in Pennsylvania in 1907 and became a marine biologist and nature writer. In 1954, she wrote The Sea Around Us, which won a National Book Award and was a bestseller. Later in the 1950s, she turned her attention to conservation, especially the environmental problems she saw being caused by synthetic pesticides, especially DDT. When Silent Spring was published in 1962, environmental consciousness was born in a large number of Americans. Rachel's writings were a primary force in advancing the global environmental movement. Rachel will be speaking around the classrooms of Mendocino County as part of the annual Women's History Project, put on by the Willits branch of the American Association of University Women. Now, Rachel, would you please tell us about your life and work?
I would be delighted. Good afternoon. My name is Rachel Carson. I was born in 1907 on my family's farm in Pennsylvania. As a child, I lacked a great many social skills, and I preferred instead to write stories about the acres of land where I lived. Even as I continued through high school and college, I remained fairly unpopular and focused mainly on my work. Now, initially, I was hoping to be an English major, but the tides changed for me when I shifted my studies to biology. From there, my scholastic career carried me through many courses in zoology and genetics. Unfortunately, after several members of my family died, my financial situation was in a dire state, and I was forced to abandon my attempt at a doctorate degree. So I found work with the U.S. Bureau of Fisheries as a junior aquatic biologist, analyzing data and reporting information on fish populations. It wasn't until 1945 that I encountered DDT through my studies. DDT and DDT, as well as many other pesticidal substances during this time period, was used with an astonishing fervor. This chemical especially was available for any person to purchase for dusting their lawns or spraying on the body to keep away mosquitoes. DDT led to thinner eggshells, sickly offspring, and the deaths of many various creatures, and a truly silent spring. This is why I published Silent Spring, The public needed to know about the disastrous effects of the pesticides, which they so willingly sprayed and ingested. Do you guys have any questions for me?
I do. Were you surprised that there wasn't an immediate ban on these pesticides?
I wasn't very surprised, considering it was so prevalent in our community. It would take a lot of work to find a change in our community.
Could you describe the fable for tomorrow from Silent Spring?
Yes. Well, I wrote in my book about a town in the heart of America, which was in harmony with the rest of nature. And I wrote about its effects, the effects of DDT after a certain period of time. And I wrote about the death of birds and the lack of fish, plants, and the beauty in the land truly was diminished. And this really seemed to shock people into understanding that DDT truly could have this effect on our environment.
Okay. Now, what kind of praise and criticisms did you receive when Silent Spring was published?
Many people were very, very shocked to begin with, and they had a general outcry to just ban DDT right away. Many people were a bit skeptical, as to be expected. I mean, DDT was so prevalent in the community. People used it everywhere, on their lawns, on their children, you know, on their dogs. And to believe that something like that was having an adverse effect on their health was very hard for them to accept.
What inspired you to become a nature writer?
Like I said, as a child, I wasn't very popular, and so I like to write short stories. By the time I was 11, I had my first story published on the local newspaper, and it was about nature.
What led you to become a marine biologist?
I didn't want to become a marine biologist to begin with, but since my financial situation was just dwindling, I had to find a job somewhere, and the U.S. Bureau of Fisheries was the first place I turned to. And I was the first woman to have a serious job with the Bureau of Fisheries, and they hired me as a junior aquatic biologist. So from then on, marine biology was sort of my specialty.
Why was it that people were using DDT so much in the early years?
Well, DDT was first used during the wartime as a repellent for lice and as a repellent for mosquitoes. When humans apply DDT to themselves, they couldn't tell that there were any adverse effects to their health because DDT is oil soluble. It didn't absorb into their skin right away and give them, you know, adverse health effects. But after a while, it could absorb into their skin. So then after the war times, it seemed like a miracle chemical, a miracle pesticide. And until people were aware of the effects of DDT, they used it eagerly.
Oh, and you said that your writings inspired people to resist these pesticides. Now, were their efforts effective?
Yes. At the end, they were effective. It wasn't until after my death that DDT was banned in 1972, but President JFK read Silent Spring, and he was wondering if these claims I made in my book were true. And after many scientists proved them to be true, he decided that DDT should and was banned.
Now, do you believe that the effects of DDT, although they've been banned for a long time, do you think they're still prevalent in our society?
That I'm not sure of.
Okay.
Do we have any more questions for Lexi? I mean, Rachel Carson?
Could you talk about biomagnification or the accumulation of DDT? How's that work? What's that mean?
Well, like I said earlier, DDT is oil soluble. So once DDT is in the body, it moves to your body fat, and there it will accumulate. And as any creature who has this DDT in their body fat, as they reproduce, the DDT will pass on to their offspring in a bigger magnification. And this will continue on until you start seeing that a lot of these animals are becoming sick.
And a lot of that sickness was just the inability for birds to successfully reproduce, like the bald eagle?
Yes, eggshells became much thinner, and it was very difficult for a lot of species to reproduce, especially birds.
What effect did it have on other wildlife?
Well, fish that were living in aquatic areas, they simply died because they were in the water. And if a lake or, you know, a surrounding area was sprayed with DDT and the runoff would come into the water, they would constantly be ingesting this chemical. And this chemical is carcinogenic. It did cause cancer in many creatures, and it made them very sickly.
Now, I kind of want to bring this back home. Did DDT have any adverse effects directly on human beings?
Yes, I mentioned in my book, one instance is a child was playing and there was a plastic bag nearby which had DDT on it, and she died soon after because her body was small, and somehow she ingested the chemical, and soon after she died from the effects of the chemical itself.
And were there alternative safe pesticides to be used at the time?
There are alternative safe pesticides that are natural. There are different plant bases which you can use to have some of the same effects of these pesticides which people are using. However, they aren't nearly as effective as most of the pesticides that were, you know, around during my time period and even around your time period. And I feel that mankind is trying to have a control on nature which isn't very possible, because these pesticides are killing these bugs, pests, whatever they are, and nature is resilient. Eventually, these creatures are going to build up a resistance, and they will evolve past that, and then humans will be left scrambling to find a new great chemical to fill its place.
Now, do you believe that humans sometimes overstep their bounds of what they should be able to do? For instance, terraforming.
Yes, I definitely believe that humans are overstepping their bounds.
Okay, thank you.
Terraforming?
Yeah, what's terraforming mean?
Terraforming is when you take an environment which is otherwise not habitable, and through a scientific method, make it so life can be sustained in that area.
But how is that overstepping our bounds?
Well, some people believe that we should only use what is around us, what has been, quote, given to us. But others believe that we should stretch our horizons elsewhere, to other planets, for instance.
If we're taking a lifeless planet and putting life on it, isn't that a good thing?
In my belief, it is.
But we haven't really done that yet, have we?
No,
not yet. It's a few.
But we have had life forms that are orbiting around Earth, so that's kind of, removing it from the earthly domain. I mean, there are things that have lived in orbit around the Earth.
Right.
So, Rachel, chlorinated hydrocarbons, what's that about?
Chlorinated hydrocarbons are a branch of chemicals. It was found a little bit earlier than my time period that you can take any molecule and remove atoms from it and replace those atoms with different atoms. For instance, take a simple methane molecule. That's one carbon atom in the center with four hydrogen atoms attached. If you were to remove three of those hydrogen atoms and replace them with chlorine atoms, you'd be left with a chlorinated hydrocarbon known as anesthetic chloroform.
And what properties would that have? Do you know?
They have many different kinds of properties, usually are fairly toxic to humans.
Well, when I think about chlorine, I think of like bleach that we use in laundry and the chlorination of our drinking water, which, as I understand it, isn't done in Europe at all. There is no chlorination of the water there because it's considered unhealthy.
Fluoride is completely banned in water in all of Europe and Japan, but we still put it in water here.
Right, but okay, but the chlorine, the purpose of the chlorine is to kill bacteria. The fluoride is something that we believe, or some people believe, that it's good for bone structure and makes healthier bone and tooth development. But the chlorine, I mean, chlorinated hydrocarbons, I mean, that's kind of the base of a lot of stuff, the scientific revolution that has altered the planet. Okay. Let's see. Let's talk a little bit about when you were alive, did you think that in the long run, did you have an opinion about the end of pesticides? Do you know if you had that kind of an opinion when you were alive?
I hoped for the end of pesticides, yes.
In entirety?
I wouldn't say entirely I hoped for the ban of pesticides. Pesticides have been used in various forms, which were safe for the environment for thousands of years. But using pesticides which kill all life, I feel, is not safe for our environment in any way.
Now, do you believe that some pesticides in different forms may be necessary in some situations?
Yes, they would be necessary, I assume, to have a greater crop yield. Sometimes there are, you know, pests which can make us sick. This is a question which was posed to me. Is it moral to allow mosquitoes to give people malaria, or would it be better to line houses with DDT so that these mosquitoes couldn't get in and give people malaria? Now, there are some instances like that where it's really hard to say whether or not pesticides should be used.
Well, as I understand it, malaria is one of the biggest killers on the planet. I mean, I think more people die from malaria than cancer, for example. And that's with all this action that's been taken to rid the planet of malaria, which, you know, hasn't really permanently happened. Chlorinated hydrocarbons, it's just such an interesting thing that we're so used to in my time, you know, that chlorine is just like this beneficial thing that we, you know, you clean your clothes, you put it in your water to make it safe. If you have a well and the county wants you to check it out to see how clean it is and stuff, they often suggest that you put chlorine in your well, you know, to purify it, because it will kill all the bacteria. But it's like such a massive, undifferentiated thing to kill, pesticide that kills bactericide, whatever, that kills everything. And I think another thing about DDT was that it was really being passed through mother's milk a lot too, wasn't it?
Yes, through bioaccumulation and biomagnification, it would pass from mother to fetus. And you could find this in most species that were subject to DDT in the environment.
And it went on for a long time, even after DDT was no longer used. I know that it was still passing through people because of how much had accumulated in the environment. And then some countries, I mean, America banned it, but I don't think that the whole, you wouldn't know this, but I don't think that the whole world banned DDT, and it was continued, and I don't know if it's being produced now or not. So let's say if you, Rachel, were to come back now in 2013, Do you think you'd want to investigate the pesticides that we're using now?
Yes, definitely. I mean, you need to have a thorough understanding of all of these chemicals that are being used that you're subjected to every day, be it through eating food that's been sprayed with a pesticide or, you know, just encountering it in, you know, the outdoors. You need to know about these chemicals in the environment.
And it's so common that people spray their lawns with a, quote, safe, unquote, pesticide so that they have just one kind of grass coming up. And you can find it in all kinds of stores, like right here in Willits. You could go to a bunch of different stores and find pesticides that are considered, quote, safe, unquote. And I think that if you were to come back at this time period, you would be somewhat horrified that there wasn't a strongly different approach taken to the use of pesticides. What do you think about that?
Yes, I think I would be very horrified. As a matter of fact, you know, a lot of people aren't truly aware of these chemicals which they're spraying. And, you know, it's something that I feel very passionately about.
Thank you, Rachel. Rachel, could you allow Lexi Krauss back into the room? We would like to hear about the environment-related science project she has been working on at the Willits Charter School. Lexi, what is BPA and how are we exposed to it and what are your concerns about it?
Well, BPA is a chemical that was discovered in 1891, and it was used first and foremost in the 1930s to enhance the growth of cattle and poultry, as well as it was used as an estrogen replacement for women. And nowadays it's used as an epoxy resin. It's used in polycarbonates, and it's used in the linings of cans. I'm a bit concerned about it because in 2010, the FDA warned that it's possibly hazardous to fetuses, infants, and children. And at that point, it was banned in Canada, the U.S., and European Union in baby bottles. Yet in a study in 2011, it was found that 96% of pregnant women transfer BPA from their bodies to the fetus. So through bioaccumulation, nearly every person in my generation has a BPA in their body.
Now, what could this BPA do to the child?
BPA is thought to cause a lot of different problems, specifically thyroid issues, change in sexual behavior and development, possibly obesity. It's also been linked to possibly cause some kinds of cancers.
What have you gained by learning to portray Rachel Carson?
Well, I've learned a lot more about Rachel that I didn't really know before in the past. For instance, she was not a very popular person, and that sort of led her to be very passionate about something. Also, she her financial situation was very dire, and while she was in college, she received her master's in zoology, but due to financial issues, she had to abandon her college career and find work, pretty much, and through that, she became fairly successful.
Now, why did you choose Rachel to portray, of all people?
When I was in ninth grade, my environmental science teacher, Erin Vaccaro, great teacher, she had us read Silent Spring, and I was very inspired by Silent Spring. Her work just inspired me to work with chemicals as well, and since then, I've become very interested in BPA, and I've been doing some science experiments with it.
What do your science experiments entail?
Well, last year, I did a science fair project. I was testing how 100 milligrams per liter of BPA would affect the initial germination of annual ryegrass seeds. And what I found was that 44.7% of the seeds that were in contact with BPA did not germinate whatsoever. And those that did had 1.7 centimeter shorter stems and 1.5 centimeter shorter roots than seeds which weren't in contact with BPA at all. And this year, I'm currently in the middle of a project. I am seeing how 0.6 parts per billion of BPA affects the reproduction patterns of six ramshorn snails. So I have two jars, one with six snails and normal water, and one with six snails and 0.6 parts per billion. Now that's a very, 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 very tiny dilution of BPA. It was released, that number was released by the EPA as the general amount of BPA which is present in freshwater sediments. And so far, the results which I found are that the ramshorn snails in contact with BPA have produced nearly double the amount of eggs as the other snails. And I believe this is because of the estrogenic compounds in BPA itself.
Are your own goals in life similar to Rachel's?
Well, I'm not really sure what Rachel's goals were, but I aspire to be very much like Rachel, yeah.
Do you believe that Silent Spring is a mandatory read for all students?
Yes. Yes, I do. In this day and age, I feel that most students should be exposed at least to some of the findings in Silent Spring.
So back to the BPA for a second. Where is it now that we, how are people being exposed to it today? Is it banned from soup cans?
You know, I'm not sure about cans, but I do know it's banned in most plastics. Though if you don't really check, you might be getting BPA that you're not really, that you didn't really know about. And nowadays, it's in our bodies. It's already in our bodies. There's no way we can really escape from that, which is a little bit unfortunate since we don't fully understand the chemical at this point.
And would you guess that that's one of many chemicals that we don't really understand that we've introduced into our bodies and our ecosystem?
Oh, yes. And I mean, still to this day, we can't decide whether or not to completely ban BPA. I mean, the EPA says that, I believe it's the EPA that believes that it's BPA is still safe to use with our food packaging. So there's a lot of dispute, and it's a very, you know, difficult subject.
But that's the Environmental Protection Agency as opposed to Human Protection Agency.
Yes, yeah.
So the reason it's used in plastics is because it strengthens the plastic?
Yeah, it really will strengthen the plastics, and it's, since it's used as a polycarbonate, which is like a strain of different kinds of plastics, and you know, it's been used in a lot of things. It's been used in a lot of packaging.
And how was it originally used?
It was used as to make poultry and cattle grow bigger because of the hormone properties it has, and it was also used as an estrogen replacement for women. So, wow. I mean, it's already been established that this chemical has very intense hormone properties, yet it's being used to package our food.
So I assume that the idea is that when it's in a form of a plastic, because plastic is somewhat impervious when it sets, when epoxy sets, that the theory was that it's not going to leach out of that, and that's why it was considered safe to put in food packaging, correct? And yet we seem to have evidence that it is getting out and getting into people.
Yes, actually, I based my science fair project this year with the snails off of a project that was an experiment in, I believe, New Zealand. And they found that what they did is they put New Zealand mud snails, one in a bottle with no BPA, and they put some of them in a bottle that was shown to have BPA in the plastics. And the BPA leached out of the plastic and into the water, and it did have an effect on those snails, which my results are consistent with.
Now, as we know, there is a lot of plastic in our large water bodies. Now, could this BPA secrete out of our plastic and have an effect on marine life?
Yes, definitely. I mean, it's in our environment, it's in runoff. Actually, I believe that the measurement that was in general in freshwater bodies was 0.14 micrograms. And I mean, that's also a very, very tiny dilution. But, you know, through bioaccumulation, like Rachel was talking about, it can very easily enter any food web. And from that point, you know, there's going to be BPA in all of these bodies of different various creatures.
What are your career goals? Or are we ready to get on that?
Yeah, I think that what we're going to do is we're going to play a little bit of music and we're going to bring a special guest in perched high in a tree somewhere near here.
From a deeper well. I went to the river, but the river was dry. I fell to my knees and I looked to the sky. Looked to the sky and the spring rain fell. I saw the water from a deeper well. Well, looking for the water from a deeper well. From a deeper well. I was ready for the love, I was ready for the money, ready for the blood and ready for the honey, ready for the winning, ready for the bill, looking for the water from a deeper well. Some money, found that blood would drip from the honey. Found I had a thirst that I could not quell. Looking for the water from a deeper well.
Now, while we are discussing youth and the environment, we know that there is a young woman who goes by the name Warbler and is perched in a pine tree just off of Highway 101. She's part of an effort to challenge the current route for a highway bypass through Willits. This route was chosen by Caltrans and includes a great many irreversible environmental changes to the Little Lake Valley and the species that inhabit the valley. Warbler, could you tell us about yourself and how you came to be an environmental activist?
Hi, can you guys hear me okay with the highway?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, hello.
Good.
Can you hear us?
Yeah, well, I am 24 years old, and I have been here in Willits for about 4 years. Living and working on a small family farm. We have goats, who are my best friends, and we grow vegetables for farmers' market. We grow herbs for medicine, and all of this, you know, is its own form of activism or resistance or however you choose to look at it. But how I got myself into environmental activism, I think, probably starts back in Colorado where I grew up. I was surrounded by the Rocky Mountains, which, if you've never seen them, I definitely recommend it being on anybody's bucket list. But there, you know, I just so happened to be lucky enough to get involved with an outdoor adventure program in junior high school, which was called Educo. And I think that at a young age, I was exposed to this, you know, different perspective, I guess. I think it's hard for some people to understand the view that begins to unfold when you've had the opportunity to make connections in and with nature. And from those connections comes a desire to protect what you love. So I got the opportunity to have that in my life as a young person. And I think that's really kind of what sparked my interest in you know, just being a person who wants to be outdoors all the time and wants to protect all the beauty that is around us.
All right. Well, I have two questions. One being, how's the view up there? And two, what's the idea behind this protest? I just would like to have it reiterated.
Well, to answer your first question, it's pretty spectacular. I suppose minus the 101. The 101 is pretty noisy.
Right.
24/7. But I'm kind of, you know, nestled right between 101 and this ranch down here. They've got cows and sheep, and so it's kind of like being at home. And the sunsets are really, really great because I'm at a vantage point where I can see over all the oaks and the ridges, so I get to see a pretty nice sunset.
Nice.
And the second question is that more like you want to, you know, bypass reiteration or
right,
or like
exactly?
Okay, yeah. So I'm up here because we receive a lot of information. We, as a coalition that has been named Save Our Little Lake Valley, we receive a lot of information from, through another agency about Caltrans and what their plans may or may not be for starting the bypass. And so this past Monday, we heard that was going to be their start date for cutting trees on this end of the bypass. I'm on the southern end of the bypass. And basically what they would do is they would cut all the trees down to about a 4-foot stump so that migratory birds wouldn't be able to nest in them. And then they'd leave the stumps until the spring, and then they'd uproot the stumps after all the rains have kind of petered off. So hearing that news, we got some people together and shimmied up a tree, and so that, you know, I could be here and we could all be here if Caltrans showed up on Monday, which they didn't. So I'm still here and still believing that it's effective in getting the word out and getting press and talking to people such as yourselves. And so I'm still here. And I'm going to stay here.
That's great.
Do you completely oppose the bypass or just the current route for the bypass?
I oppose the bypass. There are other alternatives to the bypass. The bypass is the most obscene, silly, and pointless way to deal with the so-called traffic problem in Willits. And the traffic problem being, the 3-minute delay that you have at the intersection with 20 by the Safeway. And so that was sort of the excuse for building the bypass, but there's countless other alternatives that are really easy and cost half as much and don't mess with things. I mean, a major part of this bypass is messing with our wetlands on the north end.
What are these?
That's our ecosystem.
What are these alternatives you think of?
The alternatives are in-town solutions proposed by people who live here, and those people include the Willits Environmental Center. And they talk about different roundabouts. A roundabout is a really easy way to kind of ease traffic and not have it be so backed up. So having a roundabout at the 20, and then there's a small half a mile section of road that they could pave on the southern end of town that would then create an alternative for local traffic, because the majority of the traffic that runs through that stoplight is local traffic.
What do you do to pass the time up in that tree?
Well, I have a list of talk shows that I can call into. So that's kind of, you know, job while I'm up here. But otherwise, I read a lot and I write a lot. I sew, and that's pretty much it. Look at the sunset.
Now, I don't know much about the bypass since I live in Ukiah, but so I don't really have an opinion on it at this point. But the way I see it, if there was a bypass, would the environment of Willits improve, you know, as a small town, instead of having this vast amount of traffic traveling right through the heart of it, would it allow for Willits to prosper?
No, actually, it would do the opposite, because a lot of Willits' income, if you will, is actually from taxes that people have, from city taxes they have to pay for getting gas on that intersection. There's like, you know, four gas stations on that intersection. Right. And the city of Willits gets that tax. And so, as well as a lot of the Main Street shops, you know, all the shops on Main Street people have to drive through. So many of those places get a lot of through traffic, people just stopping by, checking things out, getting a coffee or something like that. So to build the bypass around it, the bypass has no outlet 220. So anyone who wants to get to 20 has to go through Willits anyway. But if they don't, they go around on the bypass. And the actually near the ranch that I'm on right now, they have actually given a section of their land to Caltrans, as I understand it, so that once the bypass is underway, they can actually build a truck stop there. So all of that money is going to go to the people who own that land and not to the city of Willits. If that makes sense. How I understand it.
All right. So the shops in Willits need these frequents from all of these people in order to be maintained, basically. And what was my other question? What effects would this bypass have on the ecosystem as a whole?
Right. Well, it affects lots of different diverse ecosystems. We have quite a diverse, quite a diverse valley here. If you know how to look for it. And so, you know, where I am right now, we have this beautiful oak forest. It's pretty young, but it's very beautiful. It harbors a lot of migratory birds, and so that all being cut down really obviously messes with that. And then on the northern side, a lot of people are really nervous about what it's going to do to our wetland, because you can't build a highway on top of a wetland. So what Caltrans is going to do is hire a subcontractor to actually dry up our wetland so they can build a highway on top of it. So they bring in what are called wick drains, and they are poles that are put 85 feet into the ground, and they act like the wick of a candle, and they suck up the water, basically. And so, you know, there's going to be one of those in every 5 feet for about 30 acres in our wetland. So that adds to about like 50 or 55,000 wick drains that they can dry it up before they fill it and pave it with a highway. So, I mean, that's obviously very, very destructive, and that, you know, takes away the essence of a wetland ecosystem, which is the water.
Are birds going to feel comfortable nesting in that tree while you're in it?
Well, you know, I don't know. I haven't had very many visitors. There's tons in the surrounding oaks, and I get lots of turkey vultures hovering over. But you know, for the most part, I'm pretty low key.
When did you first become interested in defending the earth?
So like I was saying, you know, I grew up in the Rocky Mountains, and I ended up doing a lot of backpacking there and having a lot of time in nature. And I think that is really important in understanding our place in that. And I think that that's kind of the perspective I was talking about, like having that perspective that you are a part of something much larger, and we all, you know, are connected and work together to make something really beautiful, which is, you know, where we live. And so, so many of the things that I see, you know, the human race doing are counteractive to that whole fragile matrix that is, you know, this planet. So I think through making those connections, that's what's really really got me passionate about protecting what's here, because what's here is perfect. If it's not broken, you know, you don't need to fix it. So it's just perfect as it is.
So what environmental activities have you been involved in before this tree sit?
Well, this is you know, definitely the most in-your-face and obvious thing that I've done in terms of environmental action. It's the most expedient, I suppose. most often, I'm just kind of on the ground doing protests and holding signs and things. And you know, for me personally, it's not always the best way to go. It's not always the most effective way. And I think previous to this, I was involved in a lot of conservation work. I worked for multiple youth corps doing conservation work and going to schools and teaching kids how to be stewards of the environment and all that stuff. And that definitely has its place. In an attempt to be more hands-on in the conservation world, I joined a chainsaw crew, actually, through a youth corps, which is funny now that I'm thinking about it because I'm sitting in a tree. But this was for thinning and invasive species removal. But it just didn't seem like the right approach to me. I kind of went into being more trying, just being more out there with it and just really not compromising and just saying no. And I've done some things through Earth First in multiple areas, their slogan is no compromise in defense of Mother Earth. And I'm sure you've all heard of Earth First. But this is definitely the most out there thing that I've done so far.
Is there any particular environmentalist that inspire you?
Sorry, say that one more time?
Is there any particular environmentalist that inspire you?
He's not exactly an environmentalist. I think I'm often inspired by John Fidel, who is an activist and a poet, but he was a co-founder of the American Indian Movement and did broadcasts from the occupation of Alcatraz. But I also see all of these forms of activism kind of one thing, and then you just sort of have your special branch of it, if that makes sense. But I think specifically for this tree sit, I've just been super, super inspired by this entire community. I mean, there are people in this community have really done their homework and are trying really hard to spread the word about the bypass. And everyone, you know, who's against it has really come out in full force through this tree sit and has come to support me and support stopping the bypass. So it's been so inspirational. And that's really what, you know, where I've gotten the most energy from.
And what does moving forward as a society mean to you?
Moving forward. I mean, people have this idea of progress, and progress being, you know, faster, stronger, better, more resilient, you know, just, you know, and it often involves so much manipulation of the planet and the Earth. So I think moving forward would be more about just being responsible citizens and educating ourselves in just kind of like the importance of what's already here and the importance of the natural aspects of the world. I mean, with not so much manipulation. And I guess I see moving forward just kind of coming into a whole different view of what it means to be a part of this whole, you know, matrix.
So how would you define a sustainable lifestyle? How would you gauge if you're living a sustainable life?
That's a good question. I think it's really hard because for me, sometimes being all out there, I say, you know, the only way you can be sustainable is if you're not a part of the system at all. And you know, but I also feel that I think that's almost, you know, at least, you know, in the Western world, almost impossible to be outside of the system because it is so, it's just so integrated into everything. But, you know, I think there are a lot of really wonderful things that people can do to be personally sustainable, but then also, you know, give that to their communities. And one, I think, is farming in a sustainable way, in a small and sustainable way, where you have quality control over what you're giving to people. And so farming and creating your own energy and your own food, your own medicine, and just not, you know, participating as much in this machine that you know, that is our system. And so I guess being sustainable, you know, kind of has to be defined by each individual, you know, by what they feel is doing good for them, their families, and their community.
Yeah, it seems to me it gets tricky because, you know, at what level are you actually sustaining? I mean, if you drive a car for much anything, it's hard to really think of yourself as absolutely sustainable. It's an interesting, I mean, the question has been brought up in this community for 40 years. People have been trying to live sustainable lives, living off the grid, using recycled building materials, growing their own food, things like that. And, you know, as kind of an experiment for, you know, maybe how we could actually live in an, well, there was a book called Ecotopia that was sort of an inspiration to lots of people that moved up here in the early 70s. And anyway, it's just, it's part of the question is, you know, how can we make ourselves more, make our lifestyle have less impact on the earth, therefore being more sustainable? And I think that, you know, education is a big part of it. You know, you said that you were working with kids, you know, in educating young people in ecological concepts, because I don't know that that's happening in the schools too much. Where Lexi goes to school, they have an environmental studies in the ninth grade, which is not typical of what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely not out there as much as it should be, and I do really believe in creating that time in education and, you know, in terms of not just ecological studies in classes, but also, you know, giving students and kids time outside and give them the recognition of their importance, you know, as a whole with their ecosystem in particular. And so, I definitely, yeah, from kindergarten up, I definitely think that you know, that all of those things should be driven home. And, you know, agricultural studies as well, you know, like small-scale sustainable agriculture, just lots of ways to get people outside and thinking about how they can work with nature, you know, as opposed to against it.
My question is, how could someone who is in their teenage years contribute to the environment and possibly live a, quote, sustainable life, or at least contribute to that? Is that possible?
Oh, I definitely think it's possible. I think it's a little more complicated because, you know, as a teenager, you're not always, you know, you're often very dependent on other people. So that's more difficult for you to make more of your own choices, as I'm sure most teenagers would say.
Right.
But I think that, you know, things like, I don't know, riding your bike and just searching for those opportunities to give yourself the chance to get involved with, you know, activism or, you know, outdoor adventure or something like that in your local area, and just kind of seek out the resources. And what I feel really strongly about is bridging gaps between generations, you know. So if you're a young person and you're like, you know, I really kind of want to figure out how to be more sustainable, or I want to figure out how to be more involved in, you know, the ecological issues of the area, there are a lot of resources and a lot of people who are older who have kind of gone through it that really know what they're talking about, and I really encourage those kinds of connections for people, just the multi-generational connection, because you can learn so much as a young person from that.
Right. And I think that the parents often have an effect on what you can and can't do in that respect. So, although, say, my mother, using her as an example, she's very sustainable. She tries to be, but it's hard in this economy to be, you know, eat organic, shop organic. And I hope that when I get older, it's much more accessible to a larger variety of people, you know.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, and that's one thing, too, as we're all talking about this, you know, we are talking from a relatively privileged standpoint, you know. And I'm like, yeah, eat organic, grow organic, do this and do that. But it's really, it's not available to everybody. And I think another important thing, especially as youth, is to learn how to kind of spread the word and get that out there to people and make it more accessible. Because it's not, I mean, I think here in like Willits and Ukiah, we're, you know, in a relatively privileged place. And there's a lot of large cities that have so many people who don't have the resources to be more sustainable and to be healthy even.
How much longer will you be up there for?
Well, that's a good question. I don't really know, which is the most interesting thing about being up here. You know, I could be down tomorrow, and I could be down, you know, a month from now. I think it just sort of depends on how things play out on the other side, what Caltrans decides to do and what the local authorities decide to do. I want to be up here as long as effective.
Have you taken the bypass bootprint tour?
Yeah, actually, I was one of the tour guides. It was scheduled through the Mendo Free School. Me and Sarah Gruski and Will Parrish were all going to be tour guides for that. I haven't been down on the ground for one yet, but the original plan was that, yeah, I would actually be leading some of those tours. And I recommend it to everyone, especially youth, you know. It's really interesting. It's really interesting stuff to learn about. And if you want to get involved or you're just curious, you know, come on a tour and just learn about what's going on. It's really a good thing to do.
And then the next one will be happening next Sunday, February 10th, from noon until 4. And if you want to take the tour, you meet at the Little Lake Grange, which is at 291 School Street in Willits, and you'll walk through and see the areas. I was really kind of shocked when I saw the first part of the tour of how much land was going to be moved, just for that very initial right by where you are. It's a huge project. And so that'll be happening next Sunday from noon until 4. And that's also going to include a workshop featuring members of the Sherwood Valley Rancheria who will discuss their people's history in the area, their efforts to protect their cultural resources in the Little Lake Valley on the Mendocino Coast, and their struggles with Caltrans regarding development of the Fort Bragg Trails Project. So we really want to thank you, Warbler, for your work and for joining our show today. And we wish you the best of luck. And we're going to need to start signing off. So thanks a lot, Warbler.
Thank you guys so much. You did a wonderful job.
All right. See ya.
That's all for this month's edition of Youth Speaks Out. Your hosts today have been me, Elios, and
Lexi.
And Miles.
Youth Speaks Out is produced in cooperation with the Safe Schools / Healthy Students Bronco Project, building resiliency opportunities for the North County. For more information about the Bronco program, please call Pat Sanborn at 459-5314 or email at patsanborn@willitsunified.com. Please visit the Bronco website at sshsbronco.org.
Youth Speaks Out is produced and directed by Dan Roberts, who may be reached by mail at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490, or through the website www.youthspeaksout.net. There you can find out more information about the project, get addresses for contacting us, get a copy of the show, and listen to many hours of previous programs in streaming audio.
The views expressed on this program are not necessarily those of KZYX. They are the views of those who expressed them. Youth Speaks Out is aired on the first Sunday of each month. Our next show will be in 4 weeks. That is March 3rd at 3 p.m. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in March.